Okay, so there is. Oh, so this is what we spoke about last week, just in terms of the background of this book. There is originally the book was clearly written in Hebrew. The Maccabees, both versions were clearly written in Hebrew. We don't have the book in Hebrew, the original text in Hebrew. We don't even have a scrap of it in Hebrew. It's very noteworthy that in Qumran, right, during the Dead Sea Scrolls area, if this was a book that was popular, all right, in the area, right, in Yehuda, in Eretz Yisrael, at the in the time of the Bayit Sheni, you would think that this book would have been there. The fact that it's not, we don't even have a scrap of it from anywhere in Qumran. I mean, there's still discussions about further excavations to do there. I mean, there might be a version of it out there somewhere, the original text, but we don't have it. What was preserved basically by the Christian Church, because these books kind of developed into they look so much like part of the Jewish canon, right? So that when they were for different reasons they were grouped together with the Jewish books when they were put in translation into Greek. They were then preserved.
Part of the Septuagint?
Not the Septuagint, but part of the. I mean, it has to do with this with this idea of translating the Bible. But it's really the Christian Church Fathers that were the ones who originally preserved these books. That's why in the Christian canon, I didn't review this information before I started, but I'm almost certain that in the Christian canon these are considered part of the Hebrew Bible, even though we don't have the original text in Hebrew. You read it in translation. And it seems like you get the feel is what we were doing last time. We're just getting a feel for it. It feels like we're reading Esther. It feels like we're reading Eicha. It feels like we're reading like Malachim. And you get this feel for these books, and it doesn't really. It seems like it fits, but it doesn't quite seem like it fits. That's kind of what I want to talk about. But the point is about these books is that they were preserved by the Christian Church, and that's why we have them today. They were originally in Hebrew, but the earliest version we have of them is Greek, because the translation seemingly was from Greek to Hebrew. Okay, what I want to do today, following up from what we did last week, which was basically a historical background of what we were looking at in the Bayit Sheni period, in the middle of the Bayit Sheni period, which is when the Hanukkah story happened, and I introduced for you the Rambam last week, well, 2 weeks ago, which I thought was just like a good introduction, not only to the Hanukkah story, but also of the rabbinic perception of what the holiday is. And then our question at hand for today is what the nature of these books are, of the books of 1 and 2 Maccabees. Now, I have to correct something that I said last week. I said something just flat out false last week about 1 and 2 Maccabees. I said that they were like Malachim Aleph, Malachim Bet, Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Bet, which were really one book and they were so long that they were split in the middle and given, this is again by the Christian Church, when they were organizing the Hebrew Bible in the Middle Ages, that's when the Shmuel Aleph, Shmuel Bet division happened. That's not this. 1 and Maccabees and 2 Maccabees are actually two contemporaneous accounts of the same story. They're two of the same histories, written by two different authors. And they were two books that were really just bunched together because they're telling the same history, but they're telling it from two different authors. Not that you should be reading this or that I'm recommending it, but if you ever read any of the New Testament, so the Synoptic Gospels are doing much of the same thing. It's not like our Tanakh. It's not like our Bible where you're reading from Bereshit till the end of Malachim, and it's telling you the same story. It's more to the extent that you have different Nevi'im, right? Kiviyachol, at the same time telling the same story but from different angles, or the same history but from different parts of the country. That's what 1 and 2 Maccabees is. It's two different authors telling a similar history, similar events, but they tell them differently. A comparative study of the two is actually very interesting. But again, that's the two books together were so large, were so long that I wasn't able to do both of them. So what we're going to do today is focus on 1 Maccabees, and I want to do just at least a basic summary of what we're talking about in this book. All right, I said if we had people, then I would stand.
Sit down.
I said if we had.
Not stand for me. That would be great.
It's not for you.
Rearrange ourselves?
No, it's fine. It's fine. So I said what we were going to do was, based on what I wanted to do, was do like a little bit of a synopsis of some of this book so you get a good feel for it. And I want that to be Be'erach, two-thirds of our discussion today, and for the last third, I want it to be a discussion of why this, you know, the question of why this book is or is not, or I shouldn't say is or is not, why this book is not in Tanakh, and, you know, how it compares to our perception of Hanukkah. Okay? Middle, you'll see in the middle of, here, I made sure to put what is, you know, probably for our purposes the most important passage here, in the middle of chapter 4 of Maccabees, which is on page 4, we'll see, which is the account of Hanukkah. Right? One Maccabees is 13 chapters long. 16 chapters long. And it's really in chapter 4, it's really half of chapter 4 that tells the story of Hanukkah. So if if you're not familiar with these books, you think that it's one long 16 chapter story of the Hanukkah story. It's not the case. Alright? So keep that in mind. That's one of the reasons that we're going to deal with at the end. If the reason to promote this book or to include it in Tanakh is because of its relevance to this holiday of Hanukkah, 90% of it, 95% of it is not relevant to Hanukkah directly. Right? Compare that, and I always use this as a good comparison. You know, if you compare that to Megillat Esther, which is the reason why we can compare it is because it's a book in Tanakh that was included in Tanakh begrudgingly, right? The Gemara in Megillah. We'll maybe talk about this at the end also. But the Gemara in Megillah actually discusses that the question of whether or not Esther should or should not be included for a number of reasons. And we'll talk about that Purim time. But the Esther is one story, right? It's 10 chapters. It's again, you know, the relative or probably around the length of Parshas Vayetze. All right. So we compare that to here. This is not a book that we, let's say we had, if there ever there was some sort of takana, that we had a mitzvah to read the Sefer HaMakabim at the time of, you know, every year on Hanukkah. This isn't something that's actually really feasible. We couldn't sit everybody down and have them read 40,000 words of a book. It's not, I mean, we would spend multiple days just sitting there the entire time. It's not possible. It's not just the practicality of it. It's the section of it in general. Okay, so here's what I want to do. Let's jump right in. We read some of it last week. I skipped around. I didn't put from the first four chapters. I'm skipping around, not doing everything. But the idea is to get a good feel of what the type of literature we're talking about here, and then we'll recap at the end. Okay. Anybody? I'll point things out as we're going. But if anybody has any comments, just speak up. Chapter 1, all right? We're on page 1, chapter 1. After Alexander, son of Philip the Macedonian, right? This is Alexander the Great, who came from the land of Kittim, had defeated Dariush, right, king of the Persians and the Medes. He succeeded him as king, all right? He had previously become king of Greece. He fought many battles, conquered strongholds, and put to death the kings of the earth. This is his worldwide military conquest, all right? You'll notice just by this verse numbers, I'm skipping around a lot. He gathered a strong army and ruled over countries, nations, and princes, and they became tributary to him. And Alexander had reigned 12 years, and he died. All right, so this is chapter 1, which is long. It's a long chapter. It's setting up the background to the revolt of the Maccabim, the Maccabees. Verse 7, and Alexander reigned. All right, so verse 8, then his officers began to rule each in his own place. From them came forth a sinful root, Antiochus Epiphanes, or Antiochus, son of Antiochus the king. All right, he had been a hostage in Rome. He began to reign in 137th year of the kingdom of the Greeks. Okay, now Rome, in the depiction of Maccabees, is an ally of Malchut Yehuda. So because of that, the fact that he was a prisoner of Rome, actually, it's funny, you'd think, when we know our history, right, from a few centuries later, you think the fact that he was a prisoner of Rome would mean that he is a common enemy of ours. But in this story, it's like foreshadowing the fact that he's actually a prisoner of an ally of ours. You've got to think about it from that perspective. All right, 11, in those days lawless men came forth from Israel and misled many, saying, let us go and make a covenant with the Gentiles round about us. For since we departed from them, many evils have come upon us. All right, so this is the lawless men. This is I don't know how many references I actually included in the jumping around that we're doing, but this lawless men, which is, again, you think about the way this stuff is said in Hebrew. This is a very, Hebrew-sounding...
Habirionim?
Yeah, well, that's not what lawless men means, but who they are is a good question. What?
They were those who assimilated.
Yeah. So a big, and I will focus on this as we're reading through these texts, how much emphasis there is on religious observance. Okay? Almost, and we'll get back to this at the end when I want to give you some of the theories for its lack of inclusion in Tanakh, but almost over the top. You can't, I mean, Esther is famously, you know, doesn't include any explicit references to God or to religious observance. But even when you compare it to Yirmiyahu, Yeshayahu, which are about direct, which are full of prophecies excoriating the people for not being observant, it's even those are not as explicit as this. Specific, referring to specific mitzvot, and constantly going back to these people who were lawless, people who had no observance to them, over and over and over again. And the heroes of our story, the Maccabim, the Hashmonaim, they are the ones who are not only military leaders, but are bringing, the word of God to bear as well. Okay. So who are these lawless men that came along? 14. They built a gymnasium in Jerusalem according to Gentile custom and removed the marks of circumcision and abandoned the Holy Covenant. They joined with the Gentiles and sold themselves to evil. All these things that they were doing, again, against the word of God. When Antiochus saw that his kingdom was established, he determined to become king of the land of Egypt, that he might reign over both kingdoms. Okay, so he was the Seleucid Empire, Antiochus, and he now wanted to take the Ptolemaic Empire also. That was North Africa, that's Egypt. He engaged Ptolemy, king of Egypt, in battle, and Ptolemy turned and fled before him, and many were wounded and fell. Okay, so now this is one of the times in history, there are a few of them, this is one of the times in history where you have one polity, you have one political rulership, you have one entity, political entity, who's ruling over both North Africa and and the Middle East. Okay, where when there's warring between these two sides, we're stuck in the middle. That's a big part of Egypt and Ashur that goes on at the end of the Bayit Rishon period. So now we have Antiochus, who's now the king of everything. So you'd think that things would be okay, but the problem is that Maccabees foreshadows this. These are lawless men, right? It's not just the by the Goyim, they're doing their Medina-shtika things, and we can ignore them. These are people who are lawless, who have an outsized interest in promoting this lack of law, this lack of observance. They came along and they built a gymnasium in Jerusalem before we even hear about him conquering Egypt. So now that we're stuck in the middle of this. Verse 20, after subduing Egypt, Antiochus returned to 143rd year. He went up against Israel and came to Jerusalem with a strong force. He arrogantly entered the sanctuary and took the golden altar, the lampstand for the light, right, the menorah, and all its utensils. 22, he took also the table for the bread, this is the shulchan with the lechem upon him, the cups for drink offerings, the bowls, he took the silver and gold and the costly vessels, he took also the hidden treasures which he found. Right, the Malachim talks about how there were these storerooms, right, that were below decks in Har HaBayit. He found everything there and he plundered for all of the valuables, all the precious stuff that he could come up with on Har HaBayit. 24, taking them all, he departed to his own land. He committed deeds of murder and spoke with great arrogance. Israel mourned deeply in every community. Okay, so he didn't destroy the Beit HaMikdash, you'll notice. He plundered it. But how do you have the daily avodah in the Beit HaMikdash without a menorah? How do you have the daily avodah in the Beit HaMikdash without a shulchan with the lechem upon him? Right? He basically removed the functionality of the Beit HaMikdash without destroying it itself.
So the Beit HaMikdash was still functioning?
So, no, it actually makes specific reference that it was desolate. He exiles people from Jerusalem, he kills people from Jerusalem, he plunders the Beit HaMikdash, and he basically sets everything in motion so that it can't function. It's not in a place where it can...
No, but before he came in.
Oh, before he came in, yeah.
Before he came in, yeah.
From the beginning of Bayit Sheni period, and Aliyat Ezra, when they started to rebuild the second Beit HaMikdash. Until this point, Beit HaMikdash is functioning. Yeah. Okay, 36. It became an ambush against the sanctuary, an evil adversary of Israel. Oh, no, go to 28. Sorry. Even the land shook for its inhabitants, and all the house of Jacob was clothed with shame. Another big important factor to emphasize here, the idea of shame. The idea of the busha of Am Yisrael throughout this whole process, and what the Maccabim stood for to actually rekindle the pride of Yehuda. Okay, 2 years later, we're in 29, 2 years later, the king sent to the cities of Yehuda a chief collector of tribute, and he came to Jerusalem with a large force. So it's not just that he made the Beit HaMikdash desolate, he's doing his tax collecting.
Could it be that where you mentioned Jacob and Shem,
So, if you read like some of the commentaries of these books, and actually the JPS is just printing one now. As a matter of fact, it was Rabbi Hochberg is on some sort of listserv that he got this. They sent an excerpt of 1 and 2 Maccabees. It's a new translation and a commentary of these two books that the JPS is publishing now. If anybody's interested, email me afterwards. I can send you. I have the PDF. So it's about 150 pages, and the commentary is excellent. If you look at all these at the commentaries, and the commentary I have, I forgot the book in the office, of Goldstein, which is the original Anchor Bible from the 70s, they're constantly pointing out all the biblical references that are going on here. Right? This is clearly an allusion to this pasuk, and this is clearly an allusion to this pasuk, which happens, by the way, all throughout Nevi'im. You see Nevi'im, you know, cutting and pasting from earlier parts in Tanakh using ways to describe it. Absolutely is the answer to your question, Jackie. We're looking at a descriptions that are very common and known to us, and they're not plagiarizing, I guess is the point. They're using language that is supposed to resonate. This is a language, right? These are, if you're thinking about the Jews that are living at this time, they have the book of Yirmiyahu, they have the book of Echa, right? They have the book of Malachim Bet. They know what the original destruction of the Beit HaMikdash was. So now you write in this type of language, this type of lamentation, this type of mourning, and it obviously resonates with these people, because a few hundred years earlier, there was a 200 years earlier, there was a destruction, and 250 years earlier, there was a destruction, and all of Bnei Israel mourned. Absolutely, is what's being alluded to here. Okay, so 36, and it came an ambush against the sanctuary and evil adversary of Israel continually. On every side of the sanctuary, they shed innocent blood. They even defiled the sanctuary. Because of them, the residents of Jerusalem fled. All right, so this is what you're asking. All right, the people left. She became a dwelling of strangers. She became strange to her offspring, and Israel forsook her. This stuff sounds so much like Megillat Eicha. Her sanctuary became desolate as a desert. Her feasts were turned into mourning. Her sadness into her reproach. Her honor into contempt. Shabbos is a big features large in these books. The observance of Shabbat. The people that are Mechalalei Shabbat, the decision whether or not to be Mechalal Shabbat in order to go to war, Shabbos is a big part here. Okay, and there's many a darshan has discussed for time immemorial about why Shabbos, why Mila, why Rosh Chodesh, why these were the things that the Antiochus and this oppression specifically earmarked. Like, why weren't they interested in, Lulav and Esrog? Why weren't they interested in, Mikra Bikurim? Why weren't they interested in Shumas and Maisers? They seem to be very focused on these. Shabbos is a really important thing. But, again, why, we can discuss another time. 41. Then the king wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people. Okay, this is this idea. This is a Greek concept of actually having, one giant empire where everybody has one culture, which is why the method was to supplant centers of Greek culture into the places that have been conquered. That was the idea. We want one people. And each should, 42, and each should give up his customs. And all the Gentiles accepted the command of the king. Many, even from Israel, gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed the idols and profaned the Sabbath. So this is ancient Greek religion that they adopted. 44, and the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the cities of Judah. He directed them to follow customs strange to the land. All right, this type of language straight out of Esther also. To forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary, to profane Sabbaths and feasts, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. They would make themselves abominable by everything unclean and profane, so that they should forget the law and change all the ordinances. And whoever does not obey the command of the king shall die. Alright? Is what I always think about when I read this paragraph. It's a description of all the bad things that are happening, and then the people are, people are devastated. Right, I skipped those psukim, but the people react with mourning and devastation, the same way that you see in Esther. 54, on the bottom of page 1.
It hasn't really changed since, when he did it, those 2 years ago. He's not really making anything new.
So I guess what's going on here is that it's by royal decree. Okay. Originally, it seemed to be more of a passive thing, but what changes in verse 41 is that there's this proactive, now that Antiochus says, conquered the area that he wants to conquer. He's consolidated power, and now he's going to build his empire. How is he going to build his empire? He's going to infuse it with culture. So everything else was kind of like this cultural diffusion before, and now it's like a proactive, what's the term that everybody uses about when we're trying to enlist the Haredim? It's the term everybody uses. It slips my mind right now. This idea where we're trying to culturally shift proactively. Right. It's not. Well, no. I'm trying to remember it, but that's what we're talking about. But there's a term that we're trying. It's like this. It's kind of like social engineering. That's not it either. Whatever. But you get what I'm talking about. 54. Now on the 50. Again, this is all the background of the story. Think of Perek Aleph and Bet. In Esther, setting up the background before we really meet our the main characters or our heroes. Now, on the 15th day of Kislev, in the 145th year, they erected a desolating sacrilege upon the altar of burnt offerings. So this is like the coup de grace. This is the part that got so bad we couldn't do any, it couldn't be get any worse. They actually erected a pesel, an idol, in the spot of the mizbeach. If you're familiar with the layout of the Beit HaMikdash, so the main mizbeach, which is in the chatzer of the Beit HaMikdash, it was outside, right outside the building. That's like the main focal point. You walk up to Har HaBayis, and that's what you see. So it was over there, that's where they on top of this, which is this big platform that when you walk up to Har HaBayis, you see it, looking up at it, that's where they put a statue.
The mosque is now.
Well, the mosque is really in the other end, right? The Al-Aqsa is on the other, is on the end of, it's on the southern part of Har HaBayis.
Uh-huh.
It's the Dome of the Rock that's on the
Dome of the Rock.
Right, that's on top of the spot of the base of Megiddo. But I'm not even talking. We're talking about right outside there. It's more like in front of where the Dome of the Rock is right now. Mm. All right, they built altars in the surrounding cities of Judah. So it wasn't just the Har HaBayis that they defiled. They also were building these mizbachot, right, which were meant to sacrifice to pagan gods and burnt incense at the doors of the house and in the streets. Okay, so a big discussion. And again, you have to try and put yourself in the shoes of the people who are reading this contemporaneously. Because that's a big part of the question that we're going to be asking about why it wasn't included in Tanakh. These are the people who are living in this period. Again, no Tanakh. They know the Nevi'im that spend ad nauseum trying to excoriate the people to get them to stop sacrificing anywhere but the Beit HaMikdash. This is a big bamot. It's a big thing in Tanakh. Now, not only are there bamot, but there are bamot to Avodah Zarah. All right, so 57, we're on page 2, where the Book of the Covenant was found in the possession of anyone. This is, again, these are like the final, this is the last straw. The Book of Covenant was found, the Torah was found in the possession of anyone, or if anyone adhered to the law, the decree of the king condemned them to death. So it's not just those big few mitzvot, it was really the possession of the Torah. And on the 25th day of the month, they offered sacrifice on the altar, which was upon the altar of the burnt offering. Okay, so they not only had them idle, not only took away mitzvot, not only punished people for having a Torah, or for learning Torah, or observing the Torah, but also on the 25th day, right? Again, keep in mind that this is like the time of desolation, the time of tragedy, which eventually turns into the time of salvation. Right? Again, what does that resonate with? Like, where does that ring reminder?
Purim?
Yeah. Right, Purim is this idea of anafochu, right? Miagom l'smachav me'evil yom tov. We're setting up the evil right now. And on the 20th, one of the things that you also want to keep in mind when reading this stuff. Let's say you're the author and you're writing a book that you want to be included in Tanakh. All right. So think as we're reading, try and see if there's any things that you notice somebody like trying too hard. I guess that's the way I would put it. If somebody's trying to put something in Tanakh, you see, if you wanted a book that let's say there was a group of rabbis over there that were deciding what was in Tanakh, and you were writing a book that you wanted to be included, what would you do in order to, what would you write in it? What would you put in it in order to try to get
it? The same language that was familiar from before.
Right, so one of the theories here about its inclusion or lack of inclusion has to do with this. The guy was trying, it's so clear that this was written with the intention of being put in Tanakh, but it's too blatant. All right, and that's why it couldn't have been accepted. We'll get back to that in a second.
Say that again, I didn't find that.
The guy's trying too hard. Okay, it's the student in the classroom who wants the teacher to give him a good grade. So they're sitting there, it's like, oh, you look very nice today. You look very nice today, Mr. Whatever. You look very nice today, Mrs. Whatever. You've done such a great job. You said that so beautifully. You're right, complimenting ad nauseum. Over the top. This book sometimes strikes you like that. Over the top, over the top, over the top. It includes so many elements of different Sifrei Tanakh. Again, the guy's trying too hard. The guy's going out of his way to try and do it, but all of them in the same book actually doesn't feel right. Okay, let's go to... So according to this decree, they do everything, it's terrible, and a very great wrath came upon Israel. That ends chapter 1 then. Chapter 2. This starts the revolt of Matityahu. Now, Matityahu is the father of... Right, Matityahu ben Yochanan kohen gadol Hashmonai. Notice, by the way, when we talk about the references to Hanukkah, we read the Rambam last week. We say it in Al Nisim. Al Nisim is the history that we are most familiar with. Do we mention Judah the Maccabee? No, we know about Matityahu ben Yochanan kohen gadol Hashmonai Ivanov. Who are Ivanov? So we know who's Ivanov. Who Maccabees actually list who they were. But Matityahu is the hero here. Okay, chapter 2. In those days, Matityahu, the son of Yochanan, son of Simeon, son of Shimon, a priest of the sons of Yehoraiv, moved from Jerusalem and settled in Modi'in. I was in Yerushalayim last week. I was in Israel last week, and I was driving past Modi'in to get to the airport. And I was, I said I really should stop and take a picture and put it on the source sheet, but I didn't. It was late. He had verse 2. He had 5 sons: John named Gadi, right? John Gadi, Simon called Dasi, Judas called Maccabeus, Eliezer called Avaron, and Jonathan called Apphis. I refer you to these to different commentaries about what these words actually mean. He saw the blasphemies being committed in Judah and Jerusalem, and said, "Alas, why was I born to see this? The ruin of my people, the ruin of the holy city, and to dwell there when it was given over to the enemy, the sanctuary given over to aliens." All right, again, very Tanakh resonant language. "Her temple has become like a man without honor. Why should we live any longer?" 13. 15. Then the king's officers, who were enforcing the apostasy, came to the city of Modi'in to make them offer sacrifice. All right, so the first thing you notice, Matityahu notices what's going on. He's appalled by it. He's like, how could this possibly be? All right? 16. And then they finally get, as he's thinking this, this is the way it's being written, as he's thinking this, the evil soldiers are knocking on the door. 16. Many from Israel came to them, and Matityahu and his sons were assembled. 17. Then the king's officers spoke to Matityahu as follows: "You are a leader, honored and great in the city, and supported by sons and brothers. Now be the first to come and do what the king commands, and all the Gentiles and the men of Judah and those that are left in Jerusalem have done. All right, then you and your sons will be numbered among the friends, to be the friend of the king." 19. But Matityahu answered and said in a loud voice, "Even if all the nations that live under the world of the king obey him, and have chosen to do his commandments, departing each one from the religion of his fathers, yet I and my sons and my brothers will live by the covenant of our fathers." Okay, this is not about pride, it's not about rebellion, it's about Shmiras Torah Mitzvos. All right, he was a frum guy. That's the way the Maccabees presents Matityahu and his sons. And they're great military leaders and they're great religious devotees. 23. When he had finished speaking these words, a Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice upon the altar in Modi'in according to the king's command. 24. When Matityahu saw it, he burned with zeal in his heart, and his heart was stirred, and he gave vent to righteous anger. He ran and he killed him upon the altar. Right, then Matityahu, skipping a few psukim, then Matityahu cried out in the city with a loud voice. We said, he killed him, he killed the soldier, and then he cried out in a loud voice in 27, "Let everyone who is zealous for the law and supports the covenant come out with me. Mila Hashem Eli." Think about, again, the biblical imagery here. And he and his sons fled to the hills and left all that they had in the city. All right, this is emphasizing the fact that they went completely penniless. They went with nothing, the shirt on their back. And it was reported to the king's officers and to the troops in Jerusalem, to the city of David, that men who had rejected the king's command had gone down into the hiding and places in the wilderness. Many pursued them and overtook them. They encamped opposite them and prepared for battle against them on the Sabbath day. Just as a complete aside, by the way, I'm reading a book right now. I actually just started it, but it's a period of history that I actually wasn't familiar with until pretty recently. During the big fear during World War II was when Germany was fighting in North Africa, that if they broke ranks, if they broke the lines in North Africa, then they would eventually have gotten into Eretz Israel. They would have gotten into British Palestine at the time. Were that to have happened, right, there was a large, not obviously nothing compared to today, but there was a large population of Jews, the yeshuv that was there. They didn't know what to do. The plan that was in place, they were planning for this eventuality. The plan that was in place was basically for the Jewish population to escape into the woods, like almost as if you're reading. This is why it's just so noticeable. To escape into the woods and to engage in militia attacks against the German army that was there, just hope with the hope of annoying them enough that they could stave off whatever military action they were planning. But that's kind of, I read this and it's the first thing that pops into my head. It's if anybody's interested, I can recommend the book to you later. Just send me an email. But that's kind of what's going on here. There's this great oppression, there's a huge military force. What would have happened if Matityahu would have taken up arms at that moment? They would have been killed. He killed the one guy and then he ran away. And he's trying now to consolidate some sort of movement while he's in hiding. Okay. So let's take a look. Let's go to 35. The enemy hastened to attack them, but they did not answer them or hurl a stone at them or block up their hiding places. So originally they're just in hiding, but they're not fighting back. For they said, "Let us all die in our innocence. Heaven and earth testify for us that you are killing us unjustly." So they attack them on the Sabbath. This is not the Hashmonaim, this is just a group of righteous people. So they attacked them on the Sabbath, and they died with their wives and children and cattle to the number of 1,000 persons. Right? Again, Shabbos is being referenced here. 39, when Matityahu and his friends learned of it, they mourned for them deeply. This group of people that were devoted to Shabbos and decided not to fight back. 41, so they made this decision on this day. Let us fight against every... So again, originally, they're hiding out in the woods, and this is when when the rebellion first starts. They made the decision on this day. Let us fight again against every man who comes to attack us on Sabbath day. Let us not all die as our brethren died in their hiding places. What does Shabbos have to do with anything here?
That you're allowed to be mechal Shabbos if it's... except for the three cardinal sins.
So, right. There are even in the Koran Halacha, there are dispensations for Shmir Shabbos for war. It's actually really interesting parsha of halachic literature for Tzahal for this stuff. But the point here is that this isn't about pride and dignity as much as it's about Shmiras HaMitzvos, right? Shabbos. You're going to come after Shabbos, that's the last straw. So originally, what are they? They're committing to fight back. All right, Matityahu and his sons are committing to fight back on Shabbos. Let us fight against every man who comes to attack us on the Sabbath day. Let us not all die, our brethren died in their hiding places. Then there, united with them a company of Hasidians, mighty warriors of Israel, every one of them who offered them willingly for the law. Again, who were the people that Matityahu was allying with? The Hasidians. Right? You know, these are who, probably, what is referred to in the Gemara as the Hasidim HaRishonim. These, all right, not Mitta Kapata and the Strimal and the Pious, but the people who are just they were zealots. They were overly righteous people who were very focused on Shmiras HaMitzvos, and they stood up for something. This is excuse me. This is framed as an issue of Shmiras HaMitzvos. And the people that are coming to the aid of the Hashmonaim are the Hasidim HaRishonim. You look through the Gemara about the things that the Gemara talks about the Hasidim HaRishonim. It was not that they were great warriors. Hasidim HaRishonim, Hayu Matzin, Kotosein, Bisadosein, this is the Gemara in Bava Kama says, is that the Hasidim HaRishonim, they were so meticulous on property damage, on people injuring themselves in their property, that even though it was their own private property, they would hide any obstacles so that nobody would trip and hurt themselves. Hasidim HaRishonim, that they would be Misadrin Tfilosein, Yushaos Kodim HaTfila. They would sit hours before davening, and they would review the davening, or get ready to daven before him. These are people who were engaged in over the top religious and moral things, and these, not coincidentally, are the people that the Hashmonaim are allying with to do battle against the oppressive Greeks. 43, and all who became fugitives to escape their troubles joined them and reinforced them. So, but the military corps is Matityahu and his sons, and these Hasidim HaRishonim. 45, Matityahu and his friends went about and tore down the altars. They forcibly circumcised all the uncircumcised boys, and they found within within their borders of Israel. So now you're talking about years of lack of circumcision. There's a lot of people out here. So these Hasidim HaRishonim, these groups, again, it's very interesting. The first thing that they did was patrol the Jews and enforce Shmiras HaMitzvos, not to go and carry out attacks against the people, against the Greeks. 49. Now the days drew near for Matityahu to die. And he said to his sons, okay, so now think about the state of the rebellion and what we've heard about Matityahu so far. He gathers a force. They're there to attack anybody who comes and attacks them on Shabbos, right? And they're there to enforce religious law. In contradistinction, in the rebellion against the Greek law, but that's what their focus is. And now Matityahu is dying. Now the days draw near for Matityahu to die, and he said to his sons, arrogance and reproach have now become strong. It is a time of ruin and furious anger. Now, my children, show zeal for the law, and give your lives for the covenant of our fathers. Right? Torah and mitzvahs, that's what we're interested in. Remember the deeds of the fathers, which they did in their generations. Receive a great honor and an everlasting name. Was not Abraham found faithful when tested and was reckoned to him as righteousness? It's actually very interesting here how this is supposed to be a candidate for the book of Tanakh. These are midrashic references to the Avot. Right? The idea of Avraham being tested, of this idea of Avraham in his Nisyonot, right? Hashem Nisat Avraham, it refers to by the Akedat Yitzchak. But in every other instance, the idea of the Asara Nisyonot is not something that's referred to in the Torah. But was not Avram found faithful when tested, and it was reckoned upon him as of righteousness? Or maybe that's a reference to Akedah Yitzchak. 53, Joseph in the time of his distress kept the commandment and became Lord of Egypt. Phinehas, our father, Pinchas, because he was deeply zealous, received the covenant of everlasting priesthood. Think about who we skipped over Moshe, right? We went from Avram to Yosef to Pinchas. Okay, so we're talking about not just Shmiras HaMitzvos, but zealous Shmiras HaMitzvos. Right, in the face of great oppression. Joshua, right, Yoshua, because he fulfilled the command, became a judge in Israel. 56. Kalev, because he testified in the assembly, received an inheritance in the land. Right? So again, we skip over Moshe, but we talk about Pinchas, Kalev, and Yoshua. David, 57, because he was merciful, inherited the throne of the kingdom forever. Eliyahu, because of great zeal for the law, was taken up into heaven. Hananiah, Azariah, and Mishael. Again, we're going from, think about who we're selecting here. We're saved from the flame. Daniel, because of his innocence, was delivered from the mouth of the lions. And so observed from generation to generation that none who put their trust in him will lack strength. Okay, so you can't emphasize this enough, this speech that Matityahu gives to his sons on his deathbed. Who is the people that we're trying to emulate here? It's all the people that faced oppression, whether it was the personal oppression of Yosef in a bor or in jail, whether it was the personal oppression of Avram being tested to sacrifice his son, whether it's Eliyahu, whether it's Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah. These are all people that faced oppression and stood the test and were rewarded as a result. 65. Now behold, I know that Simeon, your brother, right? Shimon, your brother is wise in counsel. Always listen to him. He shall be your father. Again, Matityahu's deathbed wishes here are very important to pick note of because of what ends up happening. All right, Shimon, your brother, he's wise in counsel. He should be your father. In 66, Yehuda HaMakabi has been a mighty warrior from his youth. He shall command the army for you and fight the battle against the peoples. You shall rally about you all who observe the law and avenge the wrong done to your people. Pay back the Gentiles in full and heed what the law commands. Okay, so his dying wish is that Shimon ben Matityahu ben Yochanan, so Shimon be the one that takes over the religious leadership, and that Yehuda takes out, right, Judah Maccabee, he takes over the military leadership. We basically it only ends up happening that Yehuda takes over, and Yehuda ends up taking over the religious leadership also. Now think about the stories from Shmuel about how there's religious leadership and there's military leadership. And then there's the king who everything coalesces into the king. And when he fails in one or the other, it causes great problems. But think about the times of the Shoftim where there's a Navi and then there's a Shofet. Right? That's kind of the setup that Matityahu wants here on his deathbed. So then he, we're at the bottom here, 69, then he blessed them and was gathered to his fathers. 70, he died in the 140, we're on page 3 now, died in the 146th year and was buried in the tomb of his fathers in Modi'in, and all of Israel mourned for him with great lamentation. Okay, so Matityahu wasn't a great military commander. If anything, he was the spiritual leader. He was trying to rouse up the people to make sure that they follow the law. The military action that he was proposing here was more, again, think about the military action that he was proposing. What was its character? Remind me. When are we going to fight back? When they attack when?
Shabbos.
When they attack on Shabbos. Why is it that we're fighting back when they attack on Shabbos? Is it because we need to fight back for the pride of Malchut Yehuda? We need to fight back for Jewish pride? Why only on Shabbos? Think about what's going on here and what he's proposing and what his identity is. What is his deathbed wishes? Is this about pride? Is it about military strength? Is it about independence?
Potential lack of faith to fight back.
It's yeah.
When you're humiliated.
Well, maybe, but I mean, I would say that it's definitely that. But I would say that what's fueling it all is all this idea of Shmirat Torah Mitzvot. It's all religious for Matityahu. Matityahu is not interested in pride and dignity for its own sake. He's not interested in independence for its own sake.
Or nationality.
You're right.
Or for the land of Israel.
Matityahu seems to only be interested in Shmirat Torah Mitzvot. He's not worried about independence. He's not worried about toppling the Greek Empire. He's not worried about much of anything as long as the people remain faithful. If they're not faithful, we got major problems. So that's Matityahu's dying wish. Now, what
did he die of?
It doesn't say. I mean, he was an old man, I would guess. Think about Yitzchak's, other deathbed stories in Tanakh. It seems like he was an old man, and this is his last will and testament. Why did he skip Moshe? It's a great question. You have any ideas?
Didn't mention Yaakov, for whatever it's worth.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of people. He didn't mention Shmuel, and he didn't mention, he mentioned David. He didn't mention any of the Shoftim. Right? He mentioned, we skipped over Moshe, and Yitzchak and Yaakov, and we going all the way to Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, seemingly because he's choosing people that were oppressed. Now, I think you can make a good case for Moshe about growing up in Beit Paro and him being oppressed also. But again, we could spend all day just on that one speech. So much of this is golden. I mentioned last week that Aaron, the Professor Kohler, pointed out correctly, and I've always thought this also. It's funny that there are these books that talk about Jewish life in Eretz Yisrael, and nobody ever reads them because they're not part of Tanakh. I mean, halavai, everybody should just read even what's in Tanakh. But this is a very powerful stuff. That speech of Matityahu about what his dying wish was for the people is very powerful stuff. Victory in the face of oppression, being committed in the face of oppression, it's all really good. Okay, I want to skip through, I didn't put too much here, but I want to skip through...
Isn't that throughout history that religious leaders... Only interested in Shmirat Torah Mitzvot, even during the wars.
Well, that's what I was talking about, how there was classically, there's a military leader and there was a religious leader. And even the system that we have, the Kohen Gadol is supposed to, the Kohanim are supposed to accompany the people into battle. It's not because they were such, they were battle-worn, battle-tested warriors. It's because there's a huge component in the Torah's version of waging war. There's a huge component to, the religious identity of the soldiers. The actual Aron Brit, which nobody's ever allowed to lay eyes on, it's stuck in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. It's going to war. It's not only, it leads the people into war. The people's faith, the people's religious motivations at a time of battle, in the Torah's version of war, is extremely significant. And that seems to be what, again, along the lines of Matityahu, is not because we're going to wage battle for expansion of territory and political independence, but religion is the most important thing. Okay.
I don't want to be, but the founding of the State of Israel was done by secularists
This is for another time. It's for another time, but this is why, and we can understand why people have had such great opposition. Large groups of Jews, important Jews, have had such great opposition to the founding of the State of Israel.
They said you could see the hand of Hashem behind it.
Well, lots of people would say not, right? The whole Satmar ideology sees the founding of the State of Israel as a stain on the history of the Jewish people, because Israel can only be redeemed in a religious, in a religious sense. Again, this is a discussion for another time. I wanna try and zip through this. We at least need to get to the description on the next page of Hanukkah, because that's our central, at least our most relevant part of this. Yehuda HaMakabi takes over in chapter 3. Again, keep in mind what Matityahu's model was on his deathbed. Then Yehuda, his son, who was called Maccabi, took command in his place. All his brothers and all who had joined his father helped him. They gladly fought for Israel. Verse 3, he extended the glory of his people like a giant. He put on his breastplate. He girded his armor of war and waged battles, protecting the host by his sword. Okay, so immediately, Yehuda is not there to carry on the legacy of Matityahu. He's there to be, to be a military general. To put on his, think of the image. This big, hulky guy putting on his armor, standing strong. He was like a lion in his deeds, like a lion's cub roaring for prey. 5. He searched out and pursued the lawless. He burned those who troubled his people. Right, so not just the lawless people, but also the oppressors. Lawless men shrank back for fear of him. All the evildoers were confounded. Deliverance prospered by his hand. So people were terrified of this guy. He embittered many kings, but he made Jacob glad by his deeds, and his memory is blessed forever. Okay, pride, happiness being restored, not just religious observance. Excuse me. 8. He went through the cities of Judah. He destroyed the ungodly out of the land. Thus he turned away wrath from Israel. So the religious component is there, but it's part of a larger picture. He was renowned to the ends of the earth. He gathered in those who were perishing. 13. When Sauron, as I usually, for the Lord of the Rings fans, so I sometimes read here, when the commander of the Assyrian army heard that Judah had gathered a large company, including a body of faithful men who stayed with him and went out to battle, 14, he said, I will make a name for myself and win honor in the kingdom. I will make a war on Yehuda and his companions who scorned the king's command. All right, 16, Yehuda went out to meet him with a small company. But when they saw the army coming to meet them, they said to Yehuda, how can we, few as we are, fight against so great and strong a multitude? And we are faint, for we have eaten nothing today. And Yehuda replied, Not 18. You really replied, it is easy for many to be hemmed in by few, for in the sight of heaven there is no difference between saving by many or by few. It is not on the size of the army that victory in battle depends, but strength comes from heaven. Again, so Yehuda is by no means an anti-religious character. I'm just saying that it's different than the original model that Matatyahu had in mind. Yehuda is basically both factors. He's the religious icon and he's the military icon. And he seems to be presenting the military strategy in the Torah's view. He himself will crush them before us. This is a long speech that Yehuda is giving. He himself will crush them before us, as you do not be afraid of them. 23, when he finished speaking, he rushed suddenly against Seron and his army, and they were crushed before him. 25, then Yehuda and his brothers began to be feared. So this is a big, big battle that he won, and everybody now starts to fear them. And terror fell upon the Gentiles around them. When King Antiochus heard these reports, he was greatly angered, and he sent and gathered all the forces of the kingdom, a very strong army. Now Yehuda and his brothers saw these misfortunes that increased. Again, the entire book, right, the next 13 chapters are mostly stories of battles. People saw Yehuda, they saw these armies, they were angry, Antiochus was upset, he sent this battle after them, he sent this army after them, this guy, this general said, okay, I'm going to go distinguish myself, Yehuda had this strategy. It's very similar, that's why I didn't put the whole thing in. I encourage you to read it, but it's very, some of this stuff is kind of repetitive. 42. Now Yehuda and his brothers saw that misfortunes had increased and that the forces were encamped in their territory. They also learned that the king had commanded to do to the people to cause their final destruction. But they said to one another, let us repair the destruction of our people and fight for our people and the sanctuary. Now we're not just fighting for our people, we're fighting for the Beis HaMikdash. 44. And the congregation assembled to be ready for battle, to pray and ask for mercy and compassion. Yerushalayim was uninhabited like a wilderness because it was exiled years earlier. Now one of her children went in her rep. The sanctuary was trampled down and the sons of aliens held the citadel. It was a lodging place for Gentiles. Joy was taken from Jacob. The flute and the harp ceased to play. 46. So they assembled and went to Mitzpah. If anybody remember, we spoke about this. Well, I guess it wasn't in this year. It was in Shul after Mincha. But the story of Gedalia, the last military stronghold at the end of the Bayit Rishon period, the story of Gedalia happened in Mitzpah. Mitzpah is about 5 or 6 miles north. It could be like 3 miles north. It could be like 8 miles north. It's one of two places. Anybody here ever been to Nabi Samuel, Kever Shmuel HaNavi? It is literally 200 yards from the Green Line when you're driving on the State Road Golda Meir. If anybody is, I'm not recommending that you go there. But to the extent that I'm not recommending that you go there, I recommend that you go there. There isn't really a big checkpoint. It's just like a little stone block that you have to drive past. It's right before, if anybody knows where, there's a big shkuna there now, I forget. That's right past there. It'll come to me. I have a cousin that lives there. Givat Zev. It's right before Givat Zev. So you pass over the Green Line. The Givat Zev is, again, right over the Green Line. So you you pass up a little windy road, and it's a hilltop. It was a site of a very important battles, both in the British conquest in World War I, in World War II, and in the wars in 48 and 67, because it is a very important strategic spot. It's the high ground, and I've been to a lot of the area. It is by far and away, in my opinion, the most breathtakingly beautiful view of Yerushalayim and the surrounding area. It's this high point. Go at night. It seems to be like an Arab rumor that it's known as Nabi Samuel. It's where Shmuel HaNavi was buried. So it ends up being one of these Kivrei Avos that are in Yerushalayim, in Israel, and everybody goes and says Zugs Tehillim there. But it's exactly. The military history there is so significant, and it is breathtaking. Dina and I took Dina there when we, first time we were in Israel, and we were standing there, and it's like night, it's beautiful, the breeze in the summer of Yerushalayim, and she said to me, oh, this is so romantic. And I'm like, Shmuel Navi's right behind us. This is not the place for this. If you were listening to that, all right, whatever. Anyway, so that's where Mitzpah probably is, right? That's the suggestion. So they assembled to Mitzpah, but again, it's significant for Jewish history. If you know the story of Gedalia, that's where Gedalia is set up. They fasted that day, they put on sackcloth, right? They did Avelut, right? Go to 53. How will we be able to withstand them if that doesn't help us? They're davening to Hashem. 55. After this, Yehuda, right? So they go to Mitzpah, the site of important military history of Am Yisrael. They daven. 55. After this, Yehuda appointed leaders of the people in charge of thousands and hundreds and fifties and tens. He doesn't just set up an army, he sets up a whole system of army. And he said to those who were building houses, who were betrothed, who were planting vineyards, who were faint-hearted, that each should return to his home according to the law. Chapter 4. Okay. This is where we get to the main confrontation, the central confrontation between the Greek armies Antiochus' armies and Judah, the liberation of Jerusalem, and then the establishment of Hanukkah. So this is probably, for our purposes, if you want to go home and read the full chapter, chapter 4 of 1 Maccabees is the most important. 6. At daybreak, Judah appeared in the plain with 3,000 men, but they did not have armor and swords, such as they desired. And they saw the camp of the Gentiles strong and fortified with cavalry around it, and these men were trained in war. But Judah said to them, who were there, "Do not fear their numbers or be afraid when they charge. Remember how our fathers were saved at the Red Sea, when Paro and his forces pursued them. And now let us cry to heaven to see whether he will favor us and remember his covenant with our fathers and crush this army before us today." Imagine an army of 3,000 people without weapons going to attack an encampment of trained soldiers. It's suicide. It's crazy. That's the way this story is being told here. They went forth from their camp to battle. The men with Judah blew their trumpets and engaged in battle. The Gentiles were crushed and fled into the plain. Right, so this is a rout. On their return, they sang hymns and praises to heaven, for he is good. For his mercy endures forever. Thus Israel had a great deliverance that day. But the next year, I skipped a whole bunch of stuff here. Lysias is a tax collector, who's a general, who was sent by Antiochus. He mustered 60,000 picked infantrymen. This is huge numbers. And 5,000 cavalries to subdue them. They came to Adumea and encamped at Beit Sur, and Yehuda met them with 10,000 men. When he saw that the army was strong, he prayed, saying, "Blessed are you, Savior of Israel, who crushed the attack of the mighty warrior by the hand of your servant David, and gave the camp of the Pelishtim into the hands of Yonatan, the son of Shaul, Yonatan ben Shaul, and the man who carried his armor." Then both, right, again, invoking the military history of Am Yisrael. Then both sides attacked, and there fell the army of Lysias, 5,000 men. They fell in action, and when Lysias saw the rout of his troops and observed the boldness which inspired those of Judah, and how ready they were either to live or to die nobly, they departed to Antioch and enlisted mercenaries to invade Judah again with an even larger army. So they fought off this massive army that was encamped there. Then said Judah and his brothers, "Behold, our enemies are crushed. Let us go and cleanse the sanctuary and dedicate it." So they had this guy Lysias, who has this 65,000 strong army. They chase them away, and now they say, "Okay, victory." So they decide to go and reconsecrate the Beit HaMikdash. 37. So all the army assembled, and they went up to Har Zion, and they saw the sanctuary desolate, the altar profaned. This is the imagery that we're familiar with. And the gates burned. In these courts, they saw bushes spring up as in a thicket, whereas one of the mountains. They saw also the chambers of the priests in ruins. Then they rent their clothes and mourned with great lamentation and sprinkled themselves with ashes. They fell face down on the ground and sounded the signal of the trumpets and cried out to heaven. Then Judah detailed men to fight against those in the citadel until they had cleansed the sanctuary. There were people there. There were soldiers there. They were hanging around. So they had to get everybody out. That was thing number one. 42. He chose blameless priests devoted to the law. Right? He found Kohanim. And they cleansed the sanctuary and removed the defiled stones to an unclean place. Took away all of the remnants of Avodah Zarah. They deliberated what to do about the altar of burnt offering, which had been profane. So now they had the Mizbeach HaNechoshet, right? The Mizbeach that had the daily karbanot, but that was used for Avodah Zarah. They were trying to figure out what to do with it. And they thought it best to tear it down, lest it bring reproach upon them, for the Gentiles had defiled it. So they tore down the actual Mizbeach. This was an iconic structure in the Beit HaMikdash, and they tore it down and stored the stones in a convenient place on the Temple Hill until there should become a prophet to tell them what to do with them. Okay? They didn't know. They didn't have any. They didn't have a Navi there to tell them what to do with them, but they were trying to figure it out. So they paskin that they should break the Mizbeach, and they stored everything, because this is now Mamon Hektish. They couldn't just defile it, so they had to figure out what to do with it. This is our first teku, right? Our first, we'll wait until a Navi comes along to tell us. Then they took unhewn stones, as the law directs, and built a new altar, like the former one. Again, like the law directs, the law, lawless men, the law people, were trying to uphold the law. 48. They also rebuilt the sanctuary and the interior of the temple and consecrated the courts. They made new holy vessels and brought the lampstand, the altar of incense, and the table into the temple. So they made new kelim. Then they burned incense. So basically, for this account, it's believed the menorah that was taken a few centuries later by Titus in his conquest of Jerusalem was the menorah that was rebuilt by the Hashmonaim. Right, so they brought in this new stuff. They burned incense on the altar and lighted the lamps on the lampstand and gave light to the temple. They placed the bread on the table and hung up the curtains. Thus they finished all the work that they had undertaken. 52. Early in the morning on the 25th day of the ninth month, which is the month of Kislev, all right, that's our date, in 148th year, they rose and offered sacrifice as the law directs on the new altar of burnt offering which they had built. They came in. They ripped out the Beit HaMikdash to the studs. And they rebuilt it. And they built new Kalim, 54, at the very season and on the very day that the Gentiles had profaned it. Alright, again, it's they turned that date into a happy one. It was dedicated with songs and harps and lutes and cymbals. And all the people fell on their faces and worshipped and blessed heaven who had prospered them. 56, so they celebrated the dedication of the altar for 8 days and offered burnt offerings with gladness. They offered a sacrifice of deliverance and praise. They decorated the front of the temple with golden crowns and small shields. They restored the gates and the chambers for the priests and furnished them with doors. There was very great gladness among the people and the reproach of the Gentiles was removed. Then Judas and his brothers and all the assembly of Israel determined that every year at that season the days of dedication of the altar should be observed with gladness and joy for 8 days, beginning with the 25th of the month of Kislev. At that time, they fortified Har Zion with high walls and strong towers round about to keep the Gentiles from coming and trampling them down as they had done before. 61, and he stationed a garrison there to hold it. He also fortified Beit Sur so that the people might have stronghold that faced Idumea. Okay. We'll stop there of the reading inside just because we're out of time. But what do you think? All right, let's start with this. This telling of this Hanukkah story. What's glaring? What do you notice? What's there? What's not there? What's different? What's the same?
Well, he didn't really go into the 8 days or why it's 8 days.
Okay, good. So let's try and ignore everything that we know about Hanukkah until this point, right? And everything that we know about the that we've been taught our whole lives. What do you think the 8 days are is representing here? You need to know Sefer Vayikra. What?
Circus.
Sukkot could be, but I would go with something else. What do you think?
The days of Miluim.
Yeah, you're right. The days of Miluim that the Torah describes. And why does that make more sense here?
Because there was a inauguration.
Yeah, exactly. And especially when you consider the type of imagery, the type of language that's being used here, trying to rekindle this flame, trying to reestablish the Beit HaMikdash, everything according to the law, according to the law, according to the law. Right, but they don't have any Nevi'im to tell them what to do. So, in that situation, you're trying to rededicate the Beit HaMikdash. What do you think is the best way to go about doing it? So it makes sense. You look in the Torah. You see where the way the Beit HaMikdash, the first Beit HaMikdash, right, the Mishkan in the desert was established. Let's follow that system. That was the 8 days. The 25th day was the day of the dedication, and we had 8 days of dedication, of rededication of the Mishkan. That's the Hanukkah story. Okay. Let's go back to what we know, or what we've always been taught about Hanukkah. What's missing here?
The oil.
Oil. All right? We have, right, is there a mention of the menorah?
No.
It was looted and they built a new one, but it's only mentioned in the context of all the other kalim in the Beit HaMikdash. There's nothing special about the menorah. The menorah doesn't, I mean, it refers to light, that they brought light back to the Beit HaMikdash, but that could just as easily be a passing reference to, the importance of bringing, of rekindling the flames of the menorah. But the menorah is not given any specific real estate here. It's the same as all of the other kalim, right? What is, it's not even the military victory that we're celebrating. What is the celebration of Hanukkah, according to this passage? What are we celebrating? Yeah, we're celebrating the dedication, or in this case, the rededication of the Beit HaMikdash. Right, look at verse 59 again. Judah and his brothers and all the assembly of Israel determined that every year at that season, the days of the dedication of the altar should be observed. Right, the days of the dedication of the altar should be observed with gladness and joy for 8 days, beginning with the 25th of the day of the month of Kislev. It has nothing to do with the war. It has nothing to do. I mean, the war is what facilitated this. It has nothing to do with the Nesa of the Pach Shemen. It has to do with
reversal of a decree.
Yeah.
Which is similar to Purim.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's so glaring here when you look at this. When you look at this reading, how different this telling of the story is. Now, when you compare it to, we don't have time to go into this. So what I wanted to do, I knew that I wanted to spend the time on this text to give you a feel of it. But compare this to the Al Nisan that we read. When the evil and dastardly Greek armies stood upon us to make us forsake the Torah. You Hashem, Rachamech Arim, Amarta Lahem Eitzar. At you stood with the Chashmonaim. Rafta at Rivam, Danta at Dinam, Nakamta at Tikmatam, Asarti Gibarim, Yad Chalashim, Rabbi, Yamiatim, Mitmeim, Yadurim, Risham, Yasadikim, Bezinti, Yaraske Toratecha. You allowed them to win. All of those poetic references to basically allowing the Chashmonaim to win. Ulecha asita Hashem gadol v'kadosh b'olamecha. You made your name great. Ula'amcha Yisrael asita tshuva gadola for kan kayom hazeh. You, Hashem, made this great salvation for the Jewish people. Fa'achar kein, after that great salvation, achar kein, okay, so we have, I would say, one sentence in there that is consistent with this. Just the achar kein ba'u v'nechal dvir beitecha l'finu v'echal v'tiyar ad mikdashecha v'tiyar ligu v'nechal t'chat t'chat k'shecha v'kav shmur t'yumenecha elu. Right? But the explanation in Al Nisim is why were these days established? L'hodu t'lahal l'shim cha gadol. Could be not. It sounds more from our text that it's a celebration of an anniversary. It's a celebration of dedication. Yeah, you could say it's l'hodu t'lahal, but it's not.
But it would not have been possible without the military victory.
Absolutely.
And that's why they have left.
Okay, so the military... So this story is definitely consistent with the Al Nisim's telling. Well, I mean, this isn't a new question that it's glaringly absent. The Nes of the Pach Shemen is not in the in this story of the Al Nisim. Okay, that's for another time. But the point that I'm trying to make here is that here we're talking about how the military victory is directly connected. Here, it seems to be... Okay, now the military victory basically facilitated a reestablishment. But for here, it's all about lahodot lahalosh. The raftat rivam danta dinam nakamta snikmasam is part of the holiday, according to the Al Nisim. Here, it seems to be purely religious. Purely religious. We're not mixing the military part into it really at all. Okay, the military is just there to facilitate. Very quickly, why is this book not in Tanakh? Okay, so there's a lot of different scholarly theories. In the 19th century, you guys know Gratz is, right? Heinrich Gratz. Heinrich Gratz was a German historian of, and he probably is one of the most important historians, right? The historians of Jewish history. And he's definitely up there in all of Jewish history because he came along during the Enlightenment, right? During the tail end, and he was the first one to actually set out and approach the Jewish history from a scholarly perspective in the modern times. And he wrote all this history, and in part of what he wrote was one of the questions that Gratz dealt with was the canonization of the Bible. What books went in, what books went out? You were familiar with different Gemara, different passages in Chazal where they were debating certain books. They were debating Shir Hashirim, they were debating Esther, they were debating Kohelet, about whether it should be included. So how was it decided? So Gratz has this idea that around the late first century there was a council. He called it the Council of Yavne, where basically, the yeshiva in Yavne, after they were exiled from Yerushalayim, and Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai asked for Yavne v'chachameh, they sat down and they made this decision. This was for about 100 years, was accepted as the scholarly, truth. In the 70s, Dr. Lyman, my teacher, Dr. Schneer Lyman, came along for his doctoral thesis, basically disproved this. And he went through a whole bunch of different areas about how it didn't make any sense. And he dated the establishment, the closing of Tanakh to several centuries earlier. There's simple reason, according to Dr. Lyman, about why this book is not included in Tanakh, is because Tanakh was already set before the story happened. Now, this person who was writing clearly was trying to, stup another book in there. But according to Dr. Lyman, the Tanakh was already set and closed, and that's why it couldn't have been included. But I think that there are other reasons. I think that like I said, first of all, it doesn't have the same poetic and original flair many of the other Sifrei Tanakh do. It seems like the author is definitely trying very, very hard to get it included, but it's a different, but it's just like a different type of presentation. The other thing that we need to consider is when you compare this telling to the telling of Chazal, right? And for this, you really need to go through the sugyot in Masechet Shabbat that actually describe my Hanukkah. What is Hanukkah? And again, the Gemara tells us to go through the story. For Chazal, right, the Nes of the Pach Shemen looms large in this history. It's very important. It's an essential part of the day. The reason that we have 8 days of Hanukkah is because of that miracle. The reason that we have the mitzvah of Ner Hanukkah is because of that miracle. Now, even though we don't mention it in Al Nisim, right? Which is, again, a discussion for another time. It's not mentioned in here. So I'm not saying, all right, in addition to all the other reasons, all the different considerations about whether or not to include this book in Tanakh, it's when you're sitting there thinking about what the character of the day is. If this is going to be the Megillat Esther of Hanukkah, you think about the character of the day, it's setting the wrong message. And it's not a bad message, mind you. You read through this telling, and the idea of Hanukkah being a day that celebrates the rededication of the Mishkan does make sense. But without that miracle at its core, there's something missing as well. So I would suggest that, Dr. Lyman is obviously the world expert on canonization, so he's probably right. But there's this added focus. I think a separate question that we can ask is why this book fell from memory of the Jewish people for so long. There are other books in the Apocrypha, books that were external to Tanakh, that were written for Tanakh, that were not included, that are cited throughout Jewish history. Chazal talk about the book of Ben Sira, the wisdom of Ben Sira. That's a book that's part of the Apocrypha as well. But this book, there's really just no mention of it. I think it's because, one of the reasons, not just the question of its inclusion in Tanakh, but this issue of its relevance, is because without that at its core, right, and if you read through the rest of 1 Maccabees, you see it's basically a military history. This is a chapter 4. We have another 12 chapters to go, and it's battle after battle after battle, and telling the story of the glory of Yehuda HaMaccabee, and then when he dies, his brother, and then when he dies, his other brother. All of these histories aren't the central focus, which is that God protects the Jewish people and there was a miracle. So the book not only has a different focus on the central core part, which is in chapter 4, but it also has this idea of glorifying the military history of the Maccabees and the Hashmonaim. And if for that reason, I think that there's definitely at least a plausible explanation about why it's not a big part of Jewish memory and the Bible. Yeah.
Why can't you say all those military victories was of the religious miracle, the hand of God?
Well, you can, and they acknowledge it, but that's not the Hanukkah that Chazal presented. The Hanukkah of Chazal is a Hanukkah of the Pach Shemen, going in, we're reestablishing.
Where is that written?
The Pach Shemen. It's in the Gemara. We'll stop here. It's actually another interesting point.